Great. Okay. Hi. We're supposed to have a discussion this afternoon. Two discussions, actually. In a moment. Now you can hear me excellently. Okay. Well, you see, we're already behind schedule. But anyway, here's the plan. The plan is that the first discussion will be this analyzing galactic turbulence. Then I believe there's a break, right? And then there's a break. And then Enrique Vasquez de Medini and Mordecai McLowe will host the next session that will be on specifically on star formation. So we'll go up to the very dense interstellar medium in this session, but if you have something to say that's really about star formation per se, try to keep it for the other session. So our plan here is for the three of us who are supposed to be organizing this, Carl Hylas, who's right there, Barney Rickett, and me, Alyssa Goodman, to sort of go through our various specialties to familiarize the audience with what kind of observations are available and what the sort of physical regimes are, relatively quickly, so that hopefully we finish all this by around 2:40, and then we have 40 minutes, hopefully, for the section that Barney called "Cool New Results and Ideas." He said that we were in California, so we had to say "cool." And anyway, so here are the people. Please read this list if you've told us already that you'd like to say something. So these are the people who have already told us that they'd like to speak in that section, and we please don't say anything that goes on for more than 5 minutes, including discussion, or you get no cookies. So, anyway, that we will leave for later, and I will turn this over to Carl. There you go. All set.
Oh, this is so. We've been hearing a lot about the sun, in which temperatures range from 4,000 to 16 million degrees. And we have a larger temperature range in the interstellar medium. In the interstellar medium, though, instead of the density increasing with temperature, the density decreases with temperature. We tend to have, think of the interstellar medium as being composed of four phases. There's the hot ionized medium. That's the interior superbubbles, 10 to the 7 degrees, sometimes higher, ranging down. The warm ionized medium, that's photoionized gas. A large fraction of the volume is filled by the hot ionized medium, a small fraction by the warm ionized medium. We have the warm neutral medium. A large fraction of the volume is filled by that. And the cold neutral medium, and a tiny fraction is filled by that. And then everybody forgets about those particles, those important contributors to pressure, cosmic rays and magnetic field, each of which supplies as much pressure as any one of these components typically does. So it's important, I think, to remember that. Now, come to some basic questions, and when you so how does this thing?
Wait a minute. Why? I didn't turn it off.
You turned it off.
Somebody turned it off.
Oh.
Let's see. How does this thing? I don't know if I'm going to get an image on here or not, but I wanted to compare the kind of things that go on in the sun with respect to what happens in the interstellar medium, and in particular, what drives turbulence in the diffuse interstellar medium. Well, we think it's supernova and cluster supernova. What are you doing?
I want an image.
You don't. This is ruined it.
Oh. Well, let's take a break.
Man.
I don't know what you've done.
I haven't done anything.
Carl, restart your computer.
Well, that may or may not work. Supernova and cluster supernova is a standard answer. Another answer that, forget that.
No, no, it's going to work, Carl.
another answer is that most people don't.
No words from our sponsor.
That most people don't take into account so much is ionization of the neutral medium by photons to create the warm ionized medium. When that happens, pressure goes up by a factor of 2 if it's the warm neutral medium that's being ionized. It goes up by a factor of 200 if it's the cold neutral medium that's being ionized. And those are big pressure jumps. There may be other sources. Edith Fogaron told me yesterday, oh, how about galactic rotation? Maybe there are other sources. I don't know. That's something, I think, for you theorists to know about. Then the question, what dissipates turbulence in the interstellar medium? Well, I don't know what the answer to that is, but we do know some things about line widths. We know that the warm neutral medium line widths are not significantly supersonic. That's a new result, I'll talk about it later. We know that cold neutral medium line widths are mildly supersonic, maybe with typical Mach numbers of 1. That's another new result. Talk about that later. And we know that the line widths are super alphanic, that is, much larger than the alphane velocity. That's also a new result, which I'll talk about later. These apparently differ from the situation in molecular clouds. As far as the warm ionized medium and the hot ionized medium go, we don't know. And as far as another thing I wanted to point out is there's another component of the cold neutral medium. These statements in blue up there are relevant to typical parts of the cold neutral medium. There's also some cold neutral medium which is obviously shocked, and I had an image here that I was going to show that on. Doesn't work.
Your computer is only 42% rebooted.
Those shocked parts of the cold neutral medium, in contrast to the rest of the cold neutral medium, which has small magnetic fields, the shocked cold neutral medium has large field strengths of the order of 10 microgauss, where the field completely dominates all other pressures. So that's all I wanted to say about that, give you a brief review of what we have out there, about what some of us will be talking about today.
Okay.
So.
Very good, Carl.
Okay.
When your image comes back up, you can have two more minutes.
I shut it off.
Okay. No, actually, you didn't.
I didn't?
No.
Hello?
See? There it is. Normal boot up will continue in 9 seconds. Okay. Well, Carl may yet.
I didn't want to go through that. My problem is, okay, let's
That's
talk
it?
About physics.
Okay. Carl had a lovely image.
Yeah.
Can you say something more about this shock cold neutral medium?
Yes.
What is the nature of the gas that is the ionization
fraction? The ionization fraction is small. Actually, maybe I will do that with this one. The ionization fraction is small.
Carl.
It's neutral. It's compressed, and the degree in which it's compressed behind the shock is limited by the field strength. And these are typically at the edge of super bubbles. Supernova remnants, things like that. And you can pick these out by their morphology and also by their proximity to to what are obviously large superbubbles. And I will generate this and show it to you.
What are the magnetic fields observed?
The magnetic fields are observed to be of the order of 10 micrograms by Zeeman splitting.
What are the magnetic?
Zeeman splitting of 21 centimeter line. Yeah.
Most of the old neutral medium, the atomic hydrogen you observe, is it like some kind of angle of molecular clouds? So is it true that molecular clouds will be just high density big in the neutral medium, or is it correlated for molecular clouds?
Well, the molecular clouds have far higher densities than the diffusive stellar medium, which fills most of space. So I think they're basically decoupled from what goes on from the diffusion.
The neutral hydrogen can be antiparticle produced in the meter, right?
It can be, yes.
And molecular clouds, large molecular complexes only have 2 or 3 antiparticle produced in the meter, so I don't see the usefulness because right there.
Well, most of the cold neutral medium is not gravitational. Gravitation has nothing to do with it. Whereas the molecular clouds, gravitation does. Well, at least it's not negligible.
Well, there's some molecular clouds where it is negligible, like in those loops that you're talking about, right? In the Ursa Major complex, the gravitational energy is 100 times less than either the magnetic or the kinetic energy in the molecular cloud. So there are cases where it's totally unbound. So you know, the star-forming molecular clouds, the densest parts of those are bound.
Yeah, these are big of density of some molecules for the continuum.
Right. It's true that if you look at molecular clouds and then you look in H1 to see if there's some kind of H1 condensation near the molecular cloud, the answer is usually yes, but you can't see the peak because it all turned into H2.
Right.
But if you look in H1 and you just look where there's a lot of H1, is there always molecular gas? The answer to that is no, not always. Often.
The problem is it's not enough to send the shield, of course.
Right, it depends the line of sight structure.
Right. So
when you talk about molecular clouds, or at least when most people talk about molecular clouds, what I think of are these easily identifiable clouds that you need to see in absorbing the star behind, or by lots of CO emission that are sort of well-defined objects, and where gravity is significant. There are other regions, like Alyssa was talking about, where you certainly have molecules, but it's basically only a result of the diffuse region having enough column density to allow molecules to form, but gravity is still completely negligible. And I personally don't think of those as molecular clouds in the sense that we all talk about. There's a difference. Yes, sir.
Is there any recycling between the diffuse and the molecular cloud medium?
I don't know. So I heard somebody at this meeting say that goes on. I can't remember who it was. Who was it? A recycling between the diffuse and medium and the molecular.
I think George
cloud.
Said it.
It was the server who said it.
I think it may have been me.
You?
Well, only, I don't think in the sense that I can answer that, but not, I think, the answer that you want. What we were looking at is the effect of very large-scale outflows that I'll talk about later from young stars. And it is true that the outflows that extend for many parsecs go outside of what is technically the molecular cloud. So some of the gas from the molecular cloud gets ejected into the low-density interstellar medium, but what happens to it after that? You know, maybe it gets swept up into some new molecular cloud, but that's a long time in the future. So, Enrique, you have to ask about that. You want to say something, Enrique?
Well, yeah, basically, I don't have pictures with me right now, but there's the work of my graduate student, Javier Ballesteros, included doing some comparisons between simulations and observations, and putting together position velocity maps of and superposing the molecular emission and the H1 emission, trying to show that both belong to the same continuum of density. And in the simulations, we know that that's what's happening. You have clouds formed by compression, the shock, for example, and you have this continuum distribution. So he took the simulations and thresholded some density value, assuming that everything above that was molecular, and it was below that was atomic. And he got very similar looking precision velocity maps from doing that with simulation of what you get from superposing the CO and the H formation, for example, for the force. So that argues that the molecular clouds are kind of the tips of the iceberg.
About whether molecular material is recyclable.
Isn't
that
question,
how long lived
are molecular clouds? Isn't that
the
same question?
Yeah.
So,
how long lived are molecular clouds?
George, that's an entire rubric in the question and answers, I'll be ready. So.
Okay, great. Yeah, you want to move?
Carl, I have a question about your volume filling factors.
Yeah.
I noticed for the warm ionized medium you had 7%.
Right.
What would you rate as error bars? I mean, what was the range you tolerated?
Well, how do I get that? I say, okay, the height, scale height of the kiloparts. The column density to V equals infinity is about 10 to the 20. The pressure, and so that gives a mean density, okay? The pressure is, I don't know, 5,000, 4,000, whatever it is. That implies the density in the actual region is 0.5 electrons per cubic centimeter, more or less. And from that, you get a volume filling factor. So that's where that comes from.
It's assumed pressure balance.
It's assumed pressure balance.
I think we should move on.
Sorry, what pressure? Total pressure?
Thermal.
Isn't that relatively intermittent? Especially if you have a film.
Nobody knows what the. I think it's fair to say that the comparison of observed line widths in the warm ionized medium to the thermal line width has not yet been studied statistically. The data exists from the WAM survey, and they're doing a lot of things with those data. But they haven't done that yet.
But even if it's, see, if you have a medium that has thermal instability or near thermal instability, then you expect the pressure to be nearly the same as both extremes of the density distribution, yet mean that it has much to do with dynamics. It just means that, in fact, if it's thermally unstable, it acts the other way around. It acts backwards, pressure. Things rather than confining things.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that perhaps the fact that the thermal pressures are similar can be much dynamic.
That's true, but I wasn't saying that. I was only saying that to find the ratio of turbulent pressure to thermal pressure, you need compare the thermal and turbulent line widths. That can be done, it will be done, but it hasn't been done.
Do you have a picture yet?
I have to fiddle a little, I'll show a little later.
We'll let Barney go ahead with an analog presentation.
Okay, I'm one of the grab this. So I studied the interstellar medium by passing radio waves or receiving radio waves which are passed through it. Where does that go on? There we are. So I'm just going to run through some things which come from the radio probing which Jim Cordes really introduced yesterday. There's information on the density structure on the galactic scales, a disk which perhaps has a 500 parsec scale height. There's fire alarms of a lower scale height. There's an inner disk, an inner towards the galactic center. So there's an overall galactic structure of the ionized interstellar medium. The radio probing that I've had most input to is the small-scale scattering, and we model that by a wave number spectrum which looks like that. This kappa is a three-dimensional wave number spectrum, and putting together data from pulsars, mostly within 1 kiloparsec of the Earth, we came up with this. This is wave number in inverse meters. There's a parsec, there's an AU. That's right, and here's 1,000 kilometers. So this has got 12 orders of magnitude along here, and of course enormous numbers in this direction. And the radio scattering data are the points of various symbols, various methods of inferring the density structure. And remember, this is all the spectrum of the electron density. Nothing to do with velocity, magnetic field, or energy, none of the things you'd really like to know. This is the electron density. And the two lines that are plotted on here are a kappa or q to the minus 11/3, and that follows through the data pretty well. There's an implication of turbulence here. That is, this 11/3 makes you think turbulence. Q to the minus 4 is, of course, pretty close. And one of the things this graph did for me was to stimulate me to think about whether discontinuities, which would give you a spectrum which follows Q to the minus 4, whether that would explain all of these data. So I went through, I had a graduate student, and I went through an exercise with him to try and replace all of this Kolmogorov nonsense by just a random superposition of discontinuities. And the result was a failure. That is, it can't all be replaced. We can't explain the data. In spite of this fit here being fairly good, and I can show you one piece of evidence on that, and Jim showed a little of that already. On one of the pulsars, there are time of arrival measurements, two frequencies from which you can get a change in the column density, the dispersion measure with time over a good long time. This is data from the Princeton group. And if you take the structure function of that, and this is similar to what they did, except I subtracted off the noise contribution. So the structure function is like an inverse of the spectrum. This is a function of scale increasing this way. So the structure function goes in the opposite direction, and a Kolmogorov would be 5/3. So the data from that previous slide of that is that. But what's really nifty, if you like, is that, though we can't get it on this view graph at the same time, this is pinned by a point here from the scattering measurements. So there are two types of measurements on exactly the same sight line. On the previous graph, where we had this scatter plot of points, they're all from different pulsars on different directions. These are measurements on the same line of sight over 5 orders of magnitude. And I've got a lot of lines on here, but they that line and that line have both got a slope of 5/3. And 5/3 doesn't go through, doesn't join. If you take 5/3 from here, it undershoots the data up there. And so that could be due to a section which is a slope of 2, which would be an inner scale, which lies between here and here, an inner scale of this sort of time lag, which would be a spatial scale. Or it could be a Kolmogorov spectrum going like that, and then a break due to extra power at large scales. And that was what Jim was mentioning, excess power at the AU type scales. So the you can't fit this with a slope of 2 all the way across. That's the bottom line here.
What is the data from the upper here?
What's this point down here?
Yeah.
That's due to, that comes from the diffractive scintillations. I mean, a proxy for that is, you can think about this, it will be a pulse broadening. When the pulse is seen, it has a tail, and it's the width of that tail. The measurements actually come from a slightly different version of that, which is in the frequency domain. So there's an argument supporting the idea that, at least on that line of sight, the Kolmogorov spectrum is better than the discontinuity spectrum.
What's the radio spectrum?
No, it's formally an integral of the electron density turned into a phase, and it's the difference between that on two neighboring lines of sight, and the horizontal coordinate there is the separation of the lines of sight, but through a velocity. Well, I should just go back to the point here. So I was talking about this locally Kolmogorov spectrum. This Cn squared, this coefficient, is very variable on different lines of sight. And just to give you kind of a cartoon of that, what we're concerning ourselves with is the diffuse medium, which is has a 500 parsecs, say, height. And as we look out in different directions towards pulsars or AGNs or quasars, our lines of sight will sometimes pass through these highly turbulent regions. I say turbulent, but what I really mean is highly inhomogeneous. They have this Cn squared term, which is very, very large. And it can be enhanced by factors of 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 8 over the Cn squared value in the rest of the medium. And one of the big mysteries is what are those enhancements? So, these clumps, as I call them here, have perhaps a mean-free path for a line of sight hitting them of a kiloparsec or so, and they're built into Jim and Joe Taylor's model. And that's really all I want to say about the density microstructure. The Cn squared parameter is highly variable, and this kappa law is about right. And it's about right over at least 6 orders of magnitude, and I wouldn't want to extrapolate it any further. But if you do, you will, if you extrapolate it further such that you say the outer scale is, say, 10 parsecs, then you get delta n of the order n. So that was the supposition which was first invoked by Randy Jacopy a long, long time ago in the 70s. I think that the medium which causes all of this is probably the same as causes the H-alpha emission, the WIM. And I want to point out that we know very little about this medium except what we've learned about the density. There are some nice measurements of the average magnetic field from the rotation measure and the dispersion measure. There are very few measurements of the variation of delta B, the variation of B. There are almost no measurements of the variation of the velocity. I could show one which I think will put a limit of about 10 kilometers per second. Solar wind has beautiful spectra for V and B. We have none of that. We know very, very little about this medium. And I suspect, as I said, it's the same as this, what is seen in the H-alpha emission. And the warm ionized medium, it's interesting to talk about what ionizes that. Ron Reynolds' latest work confirms the idea of photoionization on the lower scale heights, but for what keeps it ionized at the higher heights, 500 parsecs, is a little more controversial. And the two processes which have been invoked are photoelectric emission from grains and the dissipation of turbulence. Now, that makes the whole thing very circular if we say it's the dissipation of turbulence. And I think that's pretty speculative. That's not my proposition, but I have read it. Yeah?
If you have the turbulence, there must be a driver somewhere up at the top of the scale, and that energy must dissipate somewhere, so I don't see why it's circular.
Well, maybe that's a little unfair to call it circular. I I've just got a few comments here, and now I'm going to put up a list of questions, which perhaps we'll which you tend to. I've mentioned this already. We don't have any information about the alphenic signature of these fluctuations. All we know is the density. The density is not thought to be a major part of the physics of the turbulence. The models which have been proposed, the density is kind of like a passive tracer of the turbulence, if it is turbulence. Of course, if it's not turbulence, we have to ask, what causes the spectrum? Let it be follow this cap to the minus 11/3. This is what I was saying. The radio data cannot be explained by discontinuity spectrum. And that's partly related to the existence of these extreme scattering events and what Jim was referring to as a spectral bump. So there's a sort of a topic in here. But I think that's my point is that that has to be in addition to an underlying spectrum which looks like a Kolmogorov spectrum. This Kolmogorov is just I'm saying that, it's a synonym for the spectral exponent of 11/3. It does not necessarily mean it's turbulent. Now then we turn to the theory a little bit, which I have not contributed to, and the theory that I read about MHD is the basis. Even though the fluid properties are hard to explain, the scales are much shorter than any mean free path, any collision length. The magnetic field is clearly critical, and if you let the magnetic field take that into account, then locally the behavior is two-dimensional, and you get a very anisotropic type of turbulence. Presumably, the tangling of the field along the line of sight is such that the signature of that anisotropy is largely erased on a long path through that medium. Yes. This is good to have discussion in mixed in. Please.
It doesn't necessarily require a very long path. Even one
crossing time.
One scale length where the magnetic field, let's say, turns around by 45 degrees. After all, it's like having interaction by two strips which are sort of crossed by 45 degrees. It could nearly have.
Well, I think it's very interesting to ask what the signature would be. Is there any measurable signature of an only partially isotropized field, like you were saying, like it's crossed like that? Whether the
scattering discs, which are 1:2, 1:3.
Yeah.
And I think the measurement by Carl and collaborators,
Carl.
Yeah.
It had these, the scattering discs were elongated perpendicular to the plane of the disc within about 90 degrees or so.
Please.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. We saw that the scattering discs were not only elongated but aligned. I suppose my hypothesis is that there are a few cases where the scattering disc has really been investigated for isotropy or anisotropy, usually in those cases, there's at least some anisotropy.
Right.
There's also cases of alignment in the signals.
It's also true that the cases where the isotropy has been most clearly identified are those cases where the scattering is quite heavy, in which case they may be localized into these clumps, and that it may be the signature of that clump which is dominating the scattering.
You're questioning whether there's a problem, you know, problem with having turbulence on all this range of scales, but that may be a little bit severe because all you really need to say is that it could have been turbulent at some time. That will do it.
Okay.
That would be a fossil of a rib. If you can give me a turbulent event on a full range of scales, then unless somehow you can get damping that's specific to the frequency band, then you'll still maintain that as a fossil.
Well, I think that's an interesting proposal, and what I don't know the lifetime of these structures if they're just left to sit there. I don't understand enough about the physics to be able to comment on the lifetime of these structures. Maybe when we get to the session on the turbulent cascades, that would be a particularly important thing to go through.
Right, but then you come out for that large scale turbulence.
You mean on the small scales?
No, the large scales, the micro.
Well, I my supposition starts at about 5 or 10 AU on the large scales or the low wave numbers, because that's where the measurements don't at larger scale than that the measurements don't.
No measurements in
the air region. Now you have to change type of measurement, and there are measurements then at sort of tenth of a hundredth of a parsec. Entirely different techniques, but it starts to stray into the density structures which are more characteristic of the neutral medium. So one is well, I mean, this is one of the things that I've got up here is the ion neutral collisions are is an important scale in here, which I think has about an AU for the mean free path for those collisions. Now, there could be energy coming in at that point, it could be taken out of that point. But, yes, yeah, so the ion neutral. Yeah. Well, I just want to put up my list of questions. I don't want to ramble on here. You know, when you're trying to generate a discussion, it's easy to ask questions. It's up to you people to try and answer them, or future students or whatever. Is there a turbulent cascade? And if so, what's the physics of that cascade? What's the energy injection process? What's the outer scale? What causes the density fluctuations? We said that the density fluctuations are secondary to the physics. If you understand the physics of the dynamics, whether they're MHD-type structures, you've still got to talk about what causes the density fluctuations. And if it's not turbulent, what determines this density spectrum we spend so long measuring? We've got to have an alternative theory. The enormous CN squared enhancements, what causes those? I recently heard Peter Gullreich and his student Lithwick propose that those are turbulence within H2 regions. They calculated the amount of turbulence if there's a Rayleigh-Taylor instability at the stronger sphere. They argued that that computed out correctly with regard to these enhanced clumps of turbulence. The dissipation mechanisms we'd like to know about.
Well,
we don't know what it is, yeah.
The clouds are part of the interstellar media. Yeah. They probably are formed by the motions of the surrounding gas. They aren't separated. They aren't something embedded in the surrounding flux. They're part of the surrounding. It's a square log chart. It's not all of it.
But I mean,
the velocities you measure are through the entire distribution of densities because you can measure the lower density stuff. And like the clouds are high density stuff, the neutral clouds are low density stuff, the ionized clouds on average are somewhat lower than the neutral, and the X rays are the very low density stuff.
But I mean, the question is linking the velocity structure, which is measured with respect to the neutral material, with the what we're talking about is structure in the ionized material. It's not clear to me that they're physically linked.
Well, it's what I was going to say. In your first sentence, you say the turbulent cascade in the low density IFM, and it's not so sure that the very large electronic density coefficients that which are observed are not very large density of poorly ionized gas, which is mostly neutral. It has been considered as completely. So it's not necessarily clear to me that it's only a cascade in the low density, total density medium.
So you're talking about the diffuse neutral gas, which
could be
ionized
within microscores.
In this case, the cascade might cut off at a scale that's much larger than.
I think the ion neutral collisions are particularly important.
But for us, on top of the cascade, because you were mentioning that there are
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. This is the discussion.
Okay. I'd like to bring up the mechanism which I mentioned before, which is well known in fluid dynamics, and it's implicit in almost everything that everybody does when they have shock waves. And that is, when you talk about what is the energy injection process and what is the scale of that process, for example, when shock waves interact with each other, they generate very thin shear layers which are on the order of the thickness of the shock wave. So those shear layers will roll up almost immediately into turbulent entities. Now, if the shock wave happens to be riding over a clumpy medium, and it doesn't have to be a nuclear shock, it can be any strong accelerating mechanism. Doesn't have to be a shock, it can be anything. But a shock is our strong accelerating mechanism. It starts covering all these entities with vorticity on the scale of the gradient of the entity. Now, somebody will say, well, magnetic fields will inhibit the turbulence. But nevertheless, the turbulence is being injected on those scale sizes.
At the size of shock.
At the size of the gradient. The gradient of the shock and the gradient, which is say a pressure jump or magnetic field gradient, and the gradient of the density of the inhomogeneity. And that process seems to be uniformly not treated in any way.
No, there are papers about this in simulation by Chevrolet.
And you're not here talking about it.
No, but it's in the astrophysical journal.
Yeah. Can we get even collisional shocks to spin as they're talking about? It's typically a shock. In the collision is warm ionized medium, I thought it had a thickness of a quarter of a parsec or something. The difference is ridiculous. Even if it's magnetic, how thin can we get it?
Normal radius.
Normal radius is
superloaded, which would be.
Besides down to this resonance down here.
Yeah. Which is.
More
the thickness of the shock.
Don't you just need the shock to start the structure? I said, don't you just need the shock to start?
All you need is a strong gradient.
Well, the gradient is a shock.
Magnetic field. Like, or even electric field.
Yeah. So I think the shocks will, if you can get the shock back then the idea that the shock interactions will indeed generate these thin sheets, I agree.
I mean, they're seeing all calculations.
Yeah. No, I'm saying if you have the shock interaction and then you let the energy cascade to smaller scales from the shock, why does the shock have to be so thin to get smaller scale structure? I don't see
that. You need to get close enough to it not have it there away in 16 centimeters or something. I think this is fine. And he said, we're here at 10 to the 8 centimeters for the shock difference is diffused.
Oh, so you're worried about the 8 orders of magnitude in between.
Yeah.
That's understandable.
It seems to me that what you said provides a possible source for the turbulence in shocks. And the question is whether that provides enough for the line of sight column density of this CN squared measure to meet the latency.
Another question I would like to throw out is it possible, for example, it's possible in simulation, but is it possible in observation to measure in these very active regions sort of a density of shocks, you know, the clumpiness associated with shocks rather than the clumpiness associated with metal?
I think the answer is probably no. I think that.
In other words, how many shocks per unit volume are there? Some supersonic
unit.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, probably. Right, that's what I said. I called
it the fucking
filter.
Yeah, I agree with
you.
Yeah.
Yay!
Okay, can you
have
the
viewer
button?
So, we've been talking about shocks. Maybe it's good to see one. This is the picture I wanted to show.
which is the Eridanus loop, Eridanus superbubble. The Sanger sky scale here is enormous. This is the galactic plane. This is latitude minus 60 degrees. At 60 degrees in the sky, this thing's 500 parsecs away. So this is hundreds of parsecs in diameter. The blue is the million to 10 million X-ray gas, which is driving a shock, which has swept up the matter, which is represented by red and green, and left a cavity in which you have the blue. So you have this dense green and red stuff around the edge. The red stuff is H-alpha emission from the Hoyan survey. It lies on the inside of the green stuff, which is neutral hydrogen. The ionization, the photons that produce that ionization are coming from the Orion Nebula, from the Orion stars, which are way up here. Those photons travel hundreds of parsecs through the evacuated region that's full of the hot ionized medium and ionize the inside of that shell. The magnetic field in this neutral region here is about 10 microgauss, and this is what I was talking about, shock, warm, shock, cold neutral medium. Now, this is one object. It's very well defined. It's rather young, 10 to the 7 years, but over time, it's going to expand, and this clarity is going to disappear. And it's my suspicion, and the way I like to look at the interstellar medium, that these different phases all started out in this way, and they now permeate interstellar space depending on the exigencies of how something happens to expand and what it runs into. And so in most of the regions, things aren't this well defined, but you still have this same kind of mixture.
Are those blue blobs real?
Yes. Many of them are, not all of them are real. This string probably isn't real. But these blue blobs, a lot of them are X-ray linked stars.
George.
My picture of the interstellar medium, which complements yours, is that these shocks go out, the material cools off and slows down, until finally it's 10 kilometers per second instead of 100 kilometers per second. When we look along the line of sight into these various media that you have discussed, we see what are sometimes called clouds, but they may in fact be shocks.
Yes, I agree with that.
Thank you.
Word done.
Would this be a time to show another picture? Yeah.
Seems to me,
sure.
Up to our chair here.
Go ahead.
While he's preparing, could I answer this gentleman over here who said, how many shocks are there?
We can turn it off. We can.
And the answer is 10 per kiloparsec. The picture that we just said is correct. 10 per kiloparsec. That's a linear measurement. That's a linear measurement. What you see is, if you go with a random sight line, you see approximately 10 of these events in 1,000 parsecs. You go different sight line, different set. So you could work out
a
space
medicine,
right?
Let me start.
I don't know about it because
Snowman. Here's another picture. These are H1 done by Cameron Stavely Smith. These are regions from the LMC that were actually picked out for their bubble-like nature. And we're looking at velocity slices through the regions. Now, what I would emphasize is not so much the bubble-like nature, but the somewhat uniform nature, because I'm now going to compare them to a simulation. Velocity slices taken by looking down on a three-dimensional simulation that was driven by supernovae. So it's just, there are the supernovae. It was just driven, it's just multiple supernovae over several tens of megayears. The supernovae distributed all across the kiloparsec squared and 10 kiloparsecs vertical out of the plane. And so what I would emphasize is that yes, there are the bubble structures, but they're going into a background that's in turn foamy or bubbly from previous supernovae, and that generates these very typical structures.
Which is what I meant by fossils. These are remnants.
Okay, so what do we do? Okay, we're only about 15 minutes behind, so I'll try and talk fast. I was charged with trying to explain a little bit about how we actually do observations of the dense interstellar medium, otherwise known as the molecular interstellar medium. And so I've chosen just a couple of topics, and because I only have a few minutes, I'm going to choose examples of my own work, surprise, surprise, to give you some demonstration. So the first one is, how exactly should we compare these very large simulations, which have just recently become possible, three-dimensional MHD simulations, with observations of the real interstellar medium? And one way that we've done it is something called a spectral correlation function, which I'll explain in a minute, but I should just say right away that there are many other ways to do this, and it boils down to how much information you want to use at the same time. Okay? So there's velocity and position information in spectral line maps. And just keep that in mind for a minute and come back to it. Okay. The next question is, for the molecular case, what might force the turbulence rapidly enough that it doesn't dissipate too quickly? And one suggestion was already made a few minutes ago is that these parsec scale outflows. And then what I'm going to leave for Mordecai and Enrique's session is the question of how turbulence in the interstellar medium settles down to actually form stars. Because one thing that you should think about in the next session is you do have to get rid of the turbulence at some point in order to actually form stars. Okay, so I have just two questions for everybody. So the first question is, what can observing simulators actually tell each other about real conditions in the interstellar medium, and what language should they speak, meaning what kind of data should they compare? And I think some of the ideas that Eve presented this morning are really great in terms of polarization maps and Zeeman measurements, and I'm just going to talk about something that's easier to obtain and to compare, which is spectral line maps. And what I mean by that is we go to radio telescopes and we take spectra at many, many positions. And remember that in all of the radio lines that we observe, the line profile itself is just a representation of the Doppler shifts of the particles in the medium that you're looking at along the line of sight. Okay? So that's all that's causing this line width. And in virtually all molecular clouds, that line width is quite substantially more than the thermal line width, so we call it a turbulent line width. Okay? Now, just to remind you how these maps are actually made, because this is what Ellen asked me to do, what we do is we go out and we find some dark cloud on the sky that we're particularly interested in, and we point the radio telescope at all these positions, and then we have to take a spectrum at every position, and we wind up with something like this, which is the intrinsic currency of these comparisons that we'll be able to make with simulations. Okay? So you have this. Sorry? Sure, you just push a button and there's your map. That's how you do it, right? Anyway, okay. No, that button would be email Alyssa. So these maps now, real observed spectral line maps, do not have whatever this is, 12 spectra as this picture here, but more like thousands of spectra. Okay, and thousands of spectra, each with thousands potentially of spectral channels, not all of which are useful, but it's a lot of information. And so what we need is for the people doing the simulations to generate synthetic spectral line maps. And Eve showed you something this morning that was density-weighted histograms of velocity, which are similar to spectra if the emission is completely optically thin. In the case where the emission is optically not thin, one has to actually do radiative transfer to generate synthetic spectra. But ultimately what we want to do is compare these spectra. What is very often done is to create something called an integrated intensity map or a channel map from these grids of spectra, both by the people doing the observations and the simulations. And what that does is take one quantity, like say the integral underneath the spectrum here, and plot it in this color scale, showing you just, if you say put an integrated map there, what total amount of stuff along the line of sight, and it's equivalent to a very good extinction map of the same region. Okay, what we want to do is not do something like this. We want to use all of this velocity information so that we compare as strictly as possible the data and the simulations. The map of structure that I saw that actually inspired this particular project was from a very big project that Edith Salgaron did with Porter Pouquet in Woodward, where she used their turbulence simulations to generate exactly what I'm talking about, a grid of synthetic spectra. This shows a mid-time phase of their simulation. Maybe Edith wants to say more about this, but what I noticed in this particular grid here was that there were spectra like this one, right next to spectra like that. There's a single peak and then this really jaggedy looking thing. And from looking at many molecular line maps, I said, you know, this doesn't look right. And things tend to change less rapidly. So we came up with this very, very simple diagnostic, which I'll explain in a second, which just basically compares the similarity of neighboring spectra. But before I explain how that works, let me just show you, this is from an earlier version of the simulations that Eve was talking about this morning. And here, the color in red here shows you sort of some kind of isodensity surface. The experts here can help me. And the blue shows you the magnetic field lines. Passive scalar injected into the cube. Yes, thank you very much. So it shows you generally the structure of the cloud. This is the case with the strong field, and this is the case with the weak field. And you can see that the field gets all tangled up here. But in this case, what we're interested in, structure-wide cubes, what we want to know is how is this gas distributed along the line of sight at what velocities and at what densities. Okay, so what we're trying to do ultimately is come up with some kind of diagnostic that can tell from a spectral line map the difference between something like this and something like this. Okay. So the way this spectral correlation function works is extraordinarily simple. All it does is take a spectrum, a target spectrum at some position in the cube, and compare it with its neighbors. Okay. There are other versions I'll show you in just a minute that compare with neighbors a little farther out and a little farther out so that you can say how the spectra change is a function of spatial scale in the cube. But the simplest version simply comes up with a measure of how similar that spectrum is to its neighbors. Now the idea of doing this, rather than just plotting, say, a histogram of line widths or a histogram of centroid velocities or the skewness of the spectra, is that was done for things like the paper that Edith wrote in 1994, and they did very well when they compared the distribution of line properties in a real data cube and a simulated data cube. What our question was is, are the spectral lines in the right place in the map? Okay, are the right spectra next to the right spectra, so are the structures ultimately right? So that's what this is supposed to do. Okay? And here's how it works. Just an example. Here's a section of little section of molecular cloud mapped in C18O. The contours here show you antenna temperature, which is just the peak of the spectrum. The grayscale in the bottom panel shows you this spectral correlation function. So where it's very dark, the spectra are all extremely similar to each other, and where it's very light, the spectra are very different from each other. The big parts that you see cut out are low signal-to-noise regions. Turns out to be very complicated to correct for noise, but we've managed to do that. Okay, so just to show you how this works, here's that same map of the spectral correlation function, and let me just plot a histogram here of all of the values in this map. So if the spectral correlation function is 1, that means that all of the spectra in the map are the same. Okay, so this is the real distribution. It's simply the distribution of grayscale in this map. Okay. Now, why am I showing you this? Well, I want to now show you, if you take exactly the same map, so the same spectrum, say you have 1,000 spectra and they're distributed on some grid, and then you randomize the positions of all of the spectra. Okay? That means that if you did some diagnostic where you just took, say, the histogram of line widths or something, you'd get exactly the same answer. You get perfect agreement. Okay? But what this does is it says, now let's recompute that spectral correlation function, and you see that you get a totally different distribution. Okay, the distribution moves down when you randomize the positions of the spectra by a great deal, and the width of this distribution also changes. So now you can use measures like this to compare real data and real simulations. Now let me just tell you that the simulations that were put in this plot are by people in this audience. So there's this one from Edith's paper in 1994. There's something that Mordecai gave us here, and there's GOS's Gamio, Stryker, and Stone. These are not meant to be their best simulations. This wasn't really a contest. These are just examples. Okay? All these color points are various kinds of molecular clouds. And the axes of this plot are, on this axis is the actual mean value of the spectral correlation function, which you can think of as the increasing similarity of one spectrum to its neighbors. Okay, so this is all the spectrum. The map are practically the same over here. On this axis is how much does that distribution shift over when you randomize the positions of the spectra. So that's the increasing similarity of all the spectra in the map. And you'll notice that the simulations are all kind of down here, okay, and the data are sort of up here. And the idea is these are different kinds of molecular clouds, they're different physical parameters in simulation, but ultimately we think that this tool will actually allow us to see, okay, which cloud falls on top of which simulation and what do we need to do to the simulation to change it from, say, a cloud where gravity doesn't matter to a cloud where gravity does matter. Hopefully the answer would be add gravity. Okay, yes?
Can I say something? The yellow
bugs,
I think,
these
are our data.
Yes, they are.
And they refer to
Q
and Q.
That's right.
And given notes of them, so that they are
definitely
sending gas which is not temperature.
Right.
And all the pink points are temperature in
cells.
Right. And
I
would say that the
non-temperature
fluid is a different kind of.
Yes, and thank you very much for pointing that out, because the idea here is that these self-gravitating clouds up here, and this was the point that we made in our original paper about this, have a much bigger change in the spectral correlation function when you randomize the positions than the clouds down here where self-gravity is less important. So what we found in our first paper was that self-gravity seemed to have some kind of organizing influence on the map. So that was one of our original results. Charles?
There's a parameter that you want to specifically, which is something like the distance between these columns.
Thank you. Yes, we're getting to the next. Here you go. Charlie showed this, and then you can ask your question. Okay, so this is something that Paolo Pedon and I have worked on recently, and he's written a beautiful paper about it that you can all read very soon. But anyway, it shows what happens if you just take one of these points that I showed you just now. So say that the lag, okay, so is 1. In other words, you're only comparing the spectrum with its neighbors. And then the value for this particular example, which is actually one of Paolo's simulations, is very, very high. The spectral correlation function for simulated 13th CO map is way up here at almost 1. And then if you increase the lag to 2 pixels, okay, what happens? The spectral correlation function drops. And then what happens is that if you actually go ahead and calculate it all for all of the relevant lags that you can calculate from simulation, you find that there's actually a short section that's a power law and exhibits some kind of self-similarity in this spectral correlation function, and that you get different power laws for different tracers. And so this actual slope of the spectral correlation function seems to be a really wonderful diagnostic of the different kinds of information that you get from the different density tracers, and you also get different slopes for different kinds of clouds. In other words, for self-gravitating clouds and non-self-gravitating clouds. And you can think of this point as our original what happens with a lag of 1, and you can think of infinite lag as randomization. So essentially, the difference between this point and that point is the difference between those two shifted, you know, original and randomized maps. That's right. Eve is saying we have density structure superimposed on velocity structure, and that's exactly right. But the point is that all we can do observationally is make a spectral line map. We can't do the marvelous thing that Eve does and pick out where exactly along the line of sight all of the emission is coming from. So with this, and there are some other tools like this, okay, there are very few that actually use the position and the velocity information at the same time, which is why I think it's advantage of this. Russell? I'm sorry. 12 CO traces relatively low density and usually somewhat optically thick gas. 13 CO is the density about 10 times higher, and CS maybe 10 times higher than that. So you actually have different structures that you're tracing with those traces. So this is this, what did somebody call it, tomography this morning that we do all the time. So we do use these different density tracers to see sort of different density regimes within a molecular cloud. Ellen?
I think this is a fascinating tool. And I have, after that,
probably
really trivial limited cases.
Sure.
So say you're looking at an object like a giant star that just had a black body spectrum.
Yeah.
Then all the spectrums look exactly like each other. They look like black body spectrums. So that's a correlation function.
One.
And if you were looking at two stars, there would be two black body spectra, and so the delta R being how far apart those things are. So there's like a, I guess as you were saying before, there's like a convolution of density information, where the gas actually is,
right.
And information about velocity, which is the code of the actual shape of the spectrum,
right.
The line has obviously thin.
Right.
So can you identify, I mean, are there any scale, any features in special correlation function that corresponds to optical depth?
Yes, absolutely. What we think is that on a very small scale, you could potentially, okay, this example doesn't show it very well, but say you have some power law regime here over some range of scales. It's very likely true that on the largest scale, this kind of turnover is only related to the size of your map, okay, or the size of your simulation. But this inner scale here could be related to a true inner scale in the data itself, okay? Now, I didn't say in the cloud itself, okay? And I did that very carefully because it could be that you have some inner scale that's imposed by the tracer becoming optically thick. Or it could be that the inner scale is real, okay? And hopefully if I get 5 minutes in Enrique's session, I'll explain what I mean by the inner scale being real. Okay, Charles, I only have one more slide here, so go ahead, yeah.
So if I could return to my...
Yes, please.
If you go back by one slide.
I can do that.
You just showed that the spectral correlation function depends on the separation. So
yes.
My question is, how do these points move around if you move the distance of the clouds
If you move the distance of the clouds around... yes. Shoot, I didn't bring that plot. But what Paolo has done is... it's beautiful. For the Rosette data, it is for the Rosette, right? Where's Paolo?
Yeah.
Yes, for the Rosette. We have two maps. We have a map from Bell Labs, and we have a map... from the FCRAO 14 meter. Maybe Paolo's going to go get it. But anyway, which are at, one is twice the resolution of the other. And when you rescale the map so that instead of plotting that next plot in pixels, you plot it in distance, the maps fall exactly on top of each other. So when you do it as a function of lag, you have to be careful to do it as a function of real physical distance. But these points are done with a lag of one pixel. And so what you're really asking about is resolution effect. Right. And so what we tested in this paper that Paolo has just finished is spatial and velocity resolution effects. And it turns out that there's a large range of spatial resolution where everything is essentially the same. But if you go to very much too coarse resolution, basically if you go outside that power law, okay, very much too coarse resolution or very much too fine resolution, you'll get different answers. But if you stay in that sort of, you know, inertial sub-range, if you will, of the spectral correlation function, then the resolution doesn't matter very much. Okay. I'll show you the actual figure of power that does show to you. Yes, Steve.
I think this is sort of related to the point that I was making earlier, because if you're looking in a higher density tracer and you're able to pick out things that are really measuring the power spectrum on the three-dimensional power spectrum, you can look at just an individual piece.
Right.
When you move to the next pixel over, you're not measuring the line width.
Right. One thing that Eve is getting at, and which I think is what I think is actually true, is that say you have this three-dimensional box in the real interstellar medium, what you have to appreciate is that these different tracers are really tracing almost isodensity surfaces. Now, an astrochemist would shudder if I said that, okay? But the reason that they would shudder is because the idea is that there's some kind of critical density, and then that tracer traces everything above that critical density. But what happens is that for various reasons, either depletion of that molecule or optical depth or whatever, it actually only traces some upper limit density also. So there's some range of densities that, say, 12 CO is sensitive to, or that ammonia is sensitive to. So when you get to the point that you have a very high density tracer, you finally get to the point where you're tracing some kind of filled volume rather than some kind of set of surfaces in the cube. So 12 CO or 13 CO, you're almost always still tracing some set of surfaces. So I'm not that surprised. I'm a little surprised by how many different features you have along the line of sight. But something like that is going on. So let me just, I don't want to hog everybody's time, so let me just say the last one thing, which is that the question is how exactly might these parsec scale flows drive turbulence in the interstellar medium? And this gets back to your point of how you actually couple to the magnetic field and to the velocity by pushing something with a very big shock. And just to give you some idea of what very big shock means, I'll show you this map, which is from Hector Arce's wonderful thesis, almost finished. Anyway, here's a star, PB-Cepheus, which is a Herbig AEBE star, and there are many knots of emission here that are hard to see, knots that show up in H-alpha as HH objects that are shocks in this very, very big outflow. And by very, very big, I mean several parsecs in length. And there are flows like this that have been found, just like Phil drew in his cartoon yesterday, permeating molecular clouds and actually extending beyond the boundaries of molecular clouds. And this is what I was talking about, George. So you should have this picture of molecular clouds actually being bombarded all the time by these gigantic outflows from stars. And even Charles and Jim in their paper a few years ago even suggested that one of the possible drivers for the turbulence could be these outflows. But as far as I know, no one has worked out in great detail, you know, whether or not the density contrast is right to sort of optimally couple the energy into the cloud. But if you just do it from a purely energy balance analysis, this is a very significant source of energy input to the cloud.
Is it a significant source?
Yes.
It is.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yes, Moshe.
Would it be appropriate to mention a few other methods of characterization at this point? Or?
Yes, except, oh God, no. Okay, let me go back to that list of people that we had, and hopefully they'll come back. But is Carl, were you first on the list?
I think Adit was.
Adit was first on the list. Okay, Adit has some nice new ISO observations of H2, and Mordecai, you... sorry. Okay, this is, by the way, for the end, right? That's what you saw, George?
Yes.
Yes. This is Carl Gwynn at the end is going to lead a discussion over coffee on what exactly we mean by turbulence. Okay? So, Adit, please.
Yeah, but I'm just being too back the issue.
It's okay. We've all taken too much time. Here.
It's not so new results because the ISO stopped flying, as you know, long time ago. And I wanted to report on the... an observation that we have done a long time. I don't want to be recorded. It was a... The line of sight was a long line of sight across the galaxy pointing toward the molecular ring. And we carefully avoided to point at bright molecular clouds and H2 regions, so we picked up the minimum of the periphery emission of the galactic ridge and a minimum of CO emission in order to sample as far as possible very standard gas in the galaxy in neutral medium. And we observed the H2 lines. Well, we observed many other lines, but I wanted to report on the H2, the pure rotational lines of H2, the five lower lines. So these are just, we detected three of them, and we have two upper limits for the S0 line because the 28 micron detectors were not working so well. It should be stronger than the S1 line. So this is the S1 line, and the upper level is 1,000K, and the S3 line, upper level 2,500K. It's normal that the noise increases at the edge of the spectrum because it's the way the wavelength at the edge of the spectrum has been span less than the central part of the spectrum, and I don't have the view graph of the S2, but it's detected too. But what I want to show you is that the spectrum that we got for this line of sight is... the pure rotational lines of H2. So the standard, I don't want to go into the details, but the spectrum is here. The two upper limits of the S0 line and the S4 line, and we have these three detections here. And these are all the models, the way we can reproduce these intensities according to the ambient medium, which is modelized as a neutral medium photoionized by the ambient photons. And we also took into account the fact that there is likely a PDR at the boundary of the molecular cloud. There is some CO, but a very small amount. But what is very striking is that the high energy part of the spectrum, even from the S2 line, is much lower than what is observed.
What is the change of
view? The quantum rotational level of the upper level. So I'm sorry for those which are not familiar. This is 2 to 0 is the S0 line, 3 to 1 is the one S1 line, and so on. And S0, S2, and S4 belong to the power species of H2, and the others belong to the ortho species. And they are not connected, the two scales, the two ladders are not connected radiatively, only by collision. And the reaction from para to ortho is endothermic. So we have tried to explain that by shocks. A large number of MHD shocks along the line of sight. And so that would answer partly the question, which was, so you see that a small number here are the shock velocities which correspond to these symbols, and the number of shocks that we need along the line of sight. The line of sight samples 20 magnitudes of gas across the galaxy. So these are the numbers of shocks of each velocity which we need to get these curves. And you notice that in the MHD shocks models, which have been done by Flower and Pino de Farré, the ortho to power ratio is 3, and it explains why the spectra look so much shaky, because there are more ortho to power than apparently what is observed. And we have done another simulation, well, modelization of vortices in which we assume that the turbulence is not dissipated in MHD shocks but in coherent vortices, and that the dissipation is viscous and also due to ion neutral drift within the vortices because there is magnetic field. And these vortices are very short, small structures. They are very short time scales. And this is the reason why the ortho to power ratio is much closer than 1, is close to 1. This is the model and this is the spectrum. And we need many more of these on the line of sight. We need 10 to the 1,000 typically per magnitude of gas. And also the dotted and dashed lines represent the spectra that we have computed when the levels of H2 are out of statistical equilibrium because of the short time scale. That's
cool. Okay, so next on our list we have
Carl.
Take
2 minutes.
I don't know, I'll take 4. You'd never believe the new results in the 21 centimeter line, but there are, I've got it. There are for emission absorption line results. That's the summary of the talk. I'll show it again later. The important point is to do the radiative transfer correctly, meaning you have to get the order of these clouds proper, and you have to put the right fraction of the warm neutral medium in front of and behind the clouds, because they absorb, those clouds absorb the radiation from that medium. And it makes a difference when you do a least square fit exactly how it works. Now, here's a result for one source. This is the absorption spectrum up on top. This is the emission spectrum, the observed one. You can see it's definitely broader, That's quite characteristic of this type of observation. And it shows that you have some warm gas and cold gas. The cold gas does the absorption. So you can fit that with those two Gaussians in the absorption spectrum plus this sort of broad Gaussian in the emission spectrum. That represents the warm neutral medium. And these two things here represent two components in the cold neutral medium. The spin temperatures are 40 and 68 degrees if you do the ordering properly. And the width of that warm neutral Gaussian implies a temperature of 2,000 degrees. It's a very odd temperature. It's not an equilibrium temperature. So some brief results. The temperature histogram here has two peaks. This is temperature down here. Number of components. There are two peaks. There's one here at 15 degrees, and there's one here at 42 degrees. I think I can comment on why I think that is, but we don't have time. You can compare the magnetic fields as derived from Zeeman splitting, let's say with the temperatures. There's a lot of upper limits down here, down in the range of a microgauss. And most of these error bars, most of these points up here have huge error bars, and so you have to be very careful about whether they're real. These ones down here have small error bars. These things have very amazingly small magnetic fields, much smaller than you would have thought. Because you get accurate temperatures and accurate line widths, you can derive the ratio of thermal width, of total width to thermal width, and that's what these points are. And it typically sits around here, most of the points are around 1.5, meaning that the typical non-thermal width is like Mach 1. There are a lot of points that are higher, but most of the points are like Mach 1. So these things are not terribly supersonic. Are they Alphaic? Well, here's a plot of the magnetic field versus the non-thermal line width. This, if it's to the left of this line, the Alphaic velocity exceeds the line width. If it's to the right of this line, the non-thermal velocity exceeds the Alphaic velocity. Most of the points are to the right. Magnetism is not important at all in these objects. Summary. I think the really important points are that, contrary to our previous thought, line widths are only mildly supersonic. Not in most objects. Some objects are quite supersonic. Line widths are subalphanic. There's no influence of the magnetic field very much on these things.
Superalphanic.
No, because these are very self-contained objects. There may be tangling within, and so the random field within the objects may be much larger than the uniform field. Can't say anything about that. Nobody can say anything about that. But within the object itself, which is probably on the order of a parsec or a few, these statements about the uniform component of the field. In the warm neutral medium, which extends over a large region of the line of sight, we don't have magnetic field strengths, but the line widths are probably more or less thermal for those. Finally, the really strange thing is that the mean field, if you just go out with a magnetometer at a point in space, you get about 5 microgauss. That's a volume average. The magnetic field in shock CNM is about 10 microgauss. These regions are randomly picked regions in the CNM, and they have upper limits almost always, less than 3 microgauss. Not always, but almost always. And this kind of violates what I would have expected from flux reason.
So you can turn zero of the square. Why? Because
people always talk about field increasing with density, and so, you know, when something gets denser, the field lines are supposed to come closer together, increasing the field strength. But the field strength in these regions is smaller, not larger, than it is in lower density regions. The people who do thermal equilibrium calculations would have a very hard time with that. No. No, these things are too well defined.
Eaton's result was that the density magnetic field is pretty flat by density. So, you know, a little wavering on the pattern.
Besides, I think Paolo has claimed that that there is not a unique line. I think, you know, a unique relation between density and magnetic field.
Yeah.
I think we confirm the same. In our clouds, our shocks in the simulation. But in fact, that means that sometimes we have field reversals in the clouds. So, you know, when you focus on little things, perhaps you'll have minima of the magnetic field.
I think that's interesting.
So I must mention this. We don't want to get lost in the detail why there is flux freezing exactly or not exactly. The basic point here is these springs are highly supraelectric, and dynamic Macaulay complexes are small density contours, just the density peaks of this spring of 100 parts per cubic centimeter that you observe. So they cannot possibly be different. If this 100 parts per cubic centimeter neutral gas is highly supraelectric, molecular clouds are supraelectric. I don't see any way out of it. The only reason why you find this and previous observations don't find this is that they couldn't sample in an unbiased way the molecular clouds, like
CO10. Let me just comment. Column densities here are at most a few times 10 to the 20. Column densities in molecular clouds are at least a few times 10 to the 21.
Otherwise, you see molecules instead of atoms, and you're going to need to
Well, there's also gravity involved. I think they're qualitatively different objects. But
is there a gravitational dynamo that I didn't know
about? The point is that when you look at gravity, if you only compare it to the bulk velocity dispersion, you're missing most of the other pressures acting on that object. Those other pressures may be as big as the bulk velocity dispersion, and therefore may rather overwhelm gravity. So they may not be nearly as self-gravitating as you're hoping.
I'm not hoping anything.
And you're planning.
These things, these wisps, gravity is nothing in these wisps.
Right.
Right. And molecular clouds. Maybe you're right.
Gravity may not be as important as molecular clouds as we think it is.
Okay, gravity is not important, magnetic field is not important. Okay.
I know. Sorry to keep this going.
I still have to bring up sort of what's the new condition measure, what's the problem. The thing that everybody should appreciate is that to measure magnetic field strength in molecular clouds is extremely difficult, and the few measurements that exist are probably the tip of the iceberg, and all those upper limits are hard to statistically include. So it's very hard to have a good estimate of really what the mean field is in molecular clouds. And also, some of the clouds that have been surveyed have very large optical polarization, which implies from these simulations and from other ideas that the field is primarily in the plane of the sky, and the Zeeman effect only measures the line of sight component of the field. So that if you bias your survey by looking all in torrents, for example, you're not going to get any detection of the line of sight field. So a lot of molecular cloud surveys have been done that way. So Paolo is right that the molecular cloud sample is biased, and you just have to wait a while until we somehow
It is not biased, like you said. If the magnetic field that is difficult to observe or intermittent, you are bound that when you detect anything, to detect the
strongest one
like a single plane.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying
you can take it. You didn't say it
was from the power. No, I'm saying two things. I'm saying that, first of all, when you are at the threshold of when you can detect, you're most likely to detect the largest.
Oh, exactly.
But also, that if you systematically look in regions where the field is likely to be in the planet's sky, then you're also not going to detect it.
Yeah.
So we don't know. We can't make some kind of statistical correction to the sample because there aren't enough observations.
Well, we can certainly put an upper limit.
I dispute your statement that the fields across the line of sight in Taurus, because your dust map shows polarizations varying by 45 degrees on the plane of the sky.
Yeah.
They're not going to vary in 45 degrees in this direction without also in that direction.
Why not?
Because that shows your observational bias.
Okay. Who on this list would still like to say something? Oh, sorry. I'm looking at this list. Okay. This is Mary Capricorn, who's going to pronounce her whole name for you correctly. I'm afraid we're going to be started at, 10 minutes later, so we'll try not to go 7 minutes more.
Okay, I just want to show you some analysis I've been doing with Peter Kopfert in Leiden and Gerdebrand in Dwingenau on galactic structure on parsec scales. And it's by radial polarization observations of the synchrotron halo, this synchrotron radiation in the galactic halo, which is modulated when it propagates through the ionized ISM of our galaxy. The observations we've been doing is with the Westerbork telescope. It's in about 3 kilometer area in the Netherlands, and we did simultaneous 5 frequencies around 350 megahertz at a resolution of about 4 arc minutes, and the only field we've looked at up till now is this field above the galactic plane. So we got all 4 Stokes parameters in all the observations, and what we see is small-scale structure in the linearly polarized intensity and angle, so a small-scale structure in Q and U, where there is no small-scale structure in the total intensity I. So the things we see is this. This is a large portion of the field, 6.4 by 9 degrees. And you see all kinds of structure. This is linearly polarized intensity. You see all kinds of structure in here, from the cloudy structure, which has a brightness temperature of up to 10K, to very long and narrow black canals without polarization, so deep polarization canals. And as I said, there is no structure in total I, so this means apparent polarization degrees of way over 100%. And this leads us to the conclusion that the responsible mechanism must be Faraday rotation, so that it's the rotation of polarization angle when the radiation falls through a magneto-ionic medium. And the rotation goes with wavelength squared, and the proportionality constant, this rotation measure, is the integral over the line of sight of parallel B fields and electron density. And because we've got these maps, these phi maps, in 5 frequencies, we can determine the rotation measure and hope to say something about B fields in this medium. So the picture we have is approximately this. This is our emitted radiation. The orange is the total intensity, it's fairly smooth, and the blue, the polarization vectors, are also pretty smooth. When this falls through a Faraday screen, still the total intensity is pretty smooth because the Faraday screen only rotates. And it rotates on small scales, so the polarization angles will be modified on small scales. And our next step is the interferometers, and an interferometer only sees small-scale structure. It cannot see large-scale structure. So what it sees is the total intensity is nothing, and that's what we see. We have no structure in I. But what it makes of the small-scale structure in Stokes Q and U is small-scale structure in polarized intensity. So this is the map I just showed you. And we've got 5 of these, and we're trying to determine rotation measures from these. And although there is some modulation by the interferometers, the striking thing is that it is possible to get reliable rotation measures from this. This is the small part of the field, and all the little graphs in here are graphs of the angle against wavelength squared, so the slope is the rotation measure. And you see that for a large part of the field, there are actually fairly reliable rotation measures possible. And this is a very preliminary map of rotation measure. This is the whole map of 9 by 11 degrees. And you see some cloudy-like structures here, which is a rotation measure of about minus 10 to plus 10 radians per square meter, and mostly even smaller. And these narrow canals are the same canals that are visible in the polarization, in the polarized intensity, and those are depolarization canals caused by beam depolarization.
Is a linear scale there again?
This is about 9 by 11 degrees is about 30 by 50 parsecs. Yeah. And if I blow up one of those canals, this is the last one. These are depolarization canals, and again these slopes are rotation measure, and you see jumps of rotation measure across those canals. And this is a rotation measure of approximately minus 3, and this is minus 5, so there are sudden jumps in rotation measure of more than 100%. And remember, these canals are only one beam wide, are 4 arc minutes wide, which is a few tens of a parsec, whereas the rotation measure is an integral of a line of sight. So this must be very sudden transitions in the ISM of rotation measure, and which indicates very sudden transitions, sudden changes in magnetic field or electrodensity. And well, this is where my research stops from now up till now, and where something like turbulence might begin. So that's why I'm here, to find out what this is. So if anybody can tell me, please do.
Tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Okay. Let's see. Hi, Carl Gibson, you want to? Okay. Okay. Barney, can we we'll skip Barney, and then we have me and Budikoff. So one more person after Carl. Brian, take 2 minutes if you can, okay?
2 minutes.
Sorry.
I know you all want coffee, so. This is not my slide, this is just an introduction. I've been working on a theory of fluid mechanical structure formation as opposed to acoustical structure formation due to genes. And this is what I wanted to show you, if you haven't seen it, are some measurements which may be relative related to whether or not the cosmic microwave background is due to sound or due to structure. And the, as you know, some of you know, the predicted peak in the temperature spectrum is thought to be due to sound. And the rest of this predicted structure in the cosmic microwave background is supposed to be due to higher order oscillations of the sound. And these new measurements from the boomerang experiment show that there are no sonic, secondary sonic peaks. And what I'm Well, I've got one side and 2 minutes. Okay, I can show you more. But these blue ones do not show these secondary peaks, and these are attempts by Wayne Wu to explain the departures, and it requires rather severe changes in the standard cosmology model, especially a tilting to get rid of these secondary peaks, which goes in the wrong direction, in my opinion, from the fossil Big Bang turbulent remnants that I expect should tilt in that direction. And I think I probably should shut up since we've got coffee coming, but the suggestion is that it's not really turbulence, it's a form of turbulence that produces a range of fluctuations of 8 orders of magnitude which then by inflation move by a factor of 10 to the 50 out to the range where the boomerang observations can be made and has a positive slope up. Now we're going to find out lots more about this in the near future when later satellites go up, so it'll be fun to keep looking for this.
Well, plasma physics by more time and this time speaking for astrophysical communities. Okay. So doesn't matter. So that's a very simple evaluation that is okay, so let's see. Let's consider three component or four component liquids, hydrogen, electron, iron, and dusty particles. Astrophysical scale, always electrons, ions magnetized by dusty particles nodes. Ions, cyclotron frequency of dusty particle micron size, it's about million year time of rotation. So we can write that Maxwell equation and plasma physics, rotation. So we can write that electron ions drifting, and there is additional ion drift due to the collision with neutrals. And we ignore in the moment that dusty particle movement. In such a case, we can resolve this equation very easily. Through electric field. Electric field is in laboratory frame. It's velocity of the molecular clouds, for example. This term, it is associated with the ambipolar drift. It's electric field, it's inductive electric field. The first term is the so-called Hall term because of particles, dust particle unmagnetized, and we need some very strong collective field to keep quasi-neutrality in the such a three-component liquids. It's very interesting that here the denominator depends not only for collision frequency of ions with neutrons, but the number of dusty particles. Number of dusty particles was evaluated in a number of papers I use, and the data from Japanese team. And because of charge of dusty particles, it's associated mostly with the very small grains, and the number of grains increases with the decreasing of diameter of grains. It's easy to estimate that is for molecular clouds, typical dense molecular clouds, that first term in this equation, second term is negligible with the first one, and we are getting such type of nonlinear equation with describing phenomenal magnetic field and shock penetration, alpha-like shock penetration, that interstellar medium. This is a well-known Gurdjieff type equation and had competed many times in the for laboratory plasma and associated with the problem of so-called plasma open switch physics, which had developed during last few minutes. Okay, so few minutes. I'm the first time speaking after 30 years in plasma physics in this community. So this is typical device in laboratory plasma which use now as a plasma open switch. And in the simulation of this device, only we must take into account that is instead of Ni, it's density of ions, in our case density of dusty particles, and electrons in our case it's ions. The space of such a new MHD, whole MHD, applying space on the distance between the one astronomical units up to 1 parsec, because inertial scale of dusty particles it's about 1 parsec. So it is a very interesting simulation. It's usual MHD simulation and whole MHD simulation of equation I just to show. You see that there is a big difference between the penetration rates. How shocks penetrate in plasma is velocity much bigger in some case or bigger than usual MHD shocks. And there is instability because of transition from the usual shocks to whole MHD shock. Now that the usual shocks very unstable because there is a more fast signal, that is whole MHD. This instability is well known in magnetotail physics, a so-called gradient instability, gradient electromagnetic kink instability.
Can you
have
to summarize?
Okay, it's summarized. So, for this community is very interesting just in collisionless plasma. The simulation was made in the beginning of 90s by Charlie Saylor. That just in the case of fast penetration of whole shocks with four motionless particles, motionless plasma, due to, in our case, dusty plasma, there is a lot of vorticity after shocks with a scale of C omega P ions. So there is a very strong collisionless shocks with a structure defined by C omega P ions. And fast transfer of the energy.
We need to.
Okay, fast. The conclusion. You can ask me what is a new type of wave, what is new type of motion. It is a well-known wave branch. It is a branch of its whistle-like oscillation, whereas in homogeneous plasma, the phenomenon I am just to describe how shock exists in two-dimensional case only, whereas the gradient density along the wave front. It's this type of instability. Now it's key issue for magnetic field reconnection. So we can say that in astrophysics there is a phenomenon of magnetic field reconnection on the scale of order one astronomical units, where the energy can convert it in ion heat. Thank you very much.